but high potential for reward area of investing in startup companies. So the reason it is unlikely to attain great wealth overnight is because what may be a good investment one day may not be a good investment after 6 months, and what was a good investment after 6 months may not be the best choice after 2 years. The more you stay up to date on your investment strategy and options, the quicker you can speed up the journey. No matter what, make sure when you venture into a new field of investing, you start small. Spend as little as you possibly can while still making the numbers make sense. If you have $1,000 to invest, do not make your first investment $500. Instead, find a type of investment where you can start off with $50. A few days or weeks later, invest another $50 or $100. This may seem conservative, and it is. When you are trying something new, you are at an increased likelihood to make an error. 95% of the time, this error will be something you were completely unaware of. This is where the foresight and wisdom of not knowing what you do not know comes into play. For your first investment or two in each area, always assume there is a key piece of information you do not even know you don't have. Everything will look perfect, but many more investments will appear to be perfect when you are missing knowledge. So treat the first few as a learning experience. Only invest what you feel comfortable losing. Think of it like you are paying for your education. The more money you risk, the more you will care. The more research you will do, the quicker you will learn, and the more deeply the learnings will impact you. However, never invest more than you can comfortably lose, especially in the beginning. What does making money mean to you? What about attaining wealth? Is there a difference? To most people, there is not. However, there is a mental distinction which should be made. Making money is when you trade your hours of time for money. Attaining wealth is when you make the money itself work for you. Let us imagine a person has a well-paying job and receives a nice big check every 2 weeks. This person is certainly making money, but is he creating wealth? To answer that question, we need a bit more information. Is he saving any of that money? If so, how much? Does he have debt? If so, how much and what type? Is he investing some of his savings? If so, what does his portfolio look like? In short, if he were making a lot of money, but then turning around and spending it all every month, he is not creating wealth. To create wealth, you must preserve and grow a portion of that money for decades to come. This is allowing your money to grow all on its own. That is not to say making money is not important. Obviously, the more money you make, the more money you have the potential to save and invest. Additionally, if you are in a poor financial situation like holding a large amount of debt, particularly high interest debt, you need to make a lot of money to dig yourself out of that hole. You cannot save and invest at a 7% annual return when your credit cards are billing you at 24% annual interest. In this case, you are making your financial situation worse, not better. So growing wealth is really a combination of the two. You want to make as much money as possible, but also invest as much of that income as possible. That is the quickest way to wealth. Do you owe any debt or have you ever owned debt? Unless you got the loan from family, and maybe even still so, you very likely paid interest on that loan. Paying interest on a loan sucks, but being on the other side of the transaction is great. Have you ever considered loans as an investment? Loaning out money with the expectation of receiving interest when it's paid back is a booming business which is growing every year. Why do you always have to be on the losing side of the equation? Don't you deserve your own cut of the debt market? First, let us look at why debt is becoming more common today. While a large part of the debt market is just individuals who don't want to wait to trade in their car, there are also hundreds of thousands of businesses across the world which would be able to expand quicker with the aid of debt. Capital is a vital resource for most businesses. It is just as important as the employees and products it pays for. If a person has a great idea for a business, but cannot afford to manufacture the products or hire any employees, how does that person build the business? Whether it be them or someone they borrow from or partner with, someone must provide capital to get the business up and running. Without the capital, there is no business. While you yourself could invest in the business, some would consider a loan to be a safer option. This could be paid back in the form of interest or in the form of a royalty. You could also take a percentage of the company until the loan is properly paid back. Provided you have done your research on the company and believe it to be a good deal, this is often a wonderful, mutually beneficial investment. Let us look at one example, which would demonstrate the symbiosis of this relationship. A small business has developed a product which they showed to a large retailer. The retailer loved it and put in a $750,000 purchase order for 100,000 units at $7.50 per unit. The only problem is the small business needs $500,000 to fulfill that order, and they don't have anywhere near that in cash reserves. Next, the investor comes along desperate to find a safe investment to grow his wealth. He verifies the purchase order and hands over $500,000 to be paid back with 10% interest upon order fulfillment. This results in a $50,000 profit for the investor and a $200,000 profit for the small business. A genuine win-win. If the company is successful, they may receive a second order for 300,000 units, as well as multiple other retailers wanting a combined 700,000 units. Again, the company will not have the cash reserves to fulfill all the orders, and the investor may have another opportunity to make some easy money. Most people will tell you luck is a huge part of attaining financial wealth. They will say other people got lucky, and they would be rich if they got lucky. But have you ever stopped to define what exactly luck is? How do you define it? Is luck stumbling upon a lottery ticket you didn't pay for while walking down the street, which happens to be worth hundreds of millions of dollars? Because a lot of people have achieved financial wealth without luck, which is straightforward. Let us look at an example, and you decide whether it is luck or not. Two tennis players are competing in the Wimbledon finals, and on one match point, the advantage player clips the top of the net and the ball goes forward, unable to be reached by the opponent. Did the winner get lucky? Now let's ask that question in a slightly different way. Did that player become world champion because of luck? While he may have experienced some degree of luck in that point, he certainly did not get to that situation in the first place due to luck. He was already winning in the match. He had already won all his previous matches in the tournament. And let us not forget the thousands of dedicated hours he put in practicing the game. Another way to look at this is by removing the expert player and replacing him with a recreational tennis player. Would this recreational player have gotten lucky? Of course not, because the recreational player would have never been there to begin with. Not only would he have not been beating the number two player in the world to an advantage match point scenario, he also wouldn't have won any of his other matches in the tournament. He would have never been able to compete in the Wimbledon because he would have never been able to win enough matches to qualify for entry. So, did he get lucky? In that very specific moment, perhaps. However, is he a world champion because he got lucky? Not even close. People tend to exaggerate the relevance of luck and understate the importance of skill, proper strategic planning, and hard work. Remember what the great Thomas Jefferson once said about luck. I am a great believer in luck, and I find the harder I work, the more I have of it. While the ultra-successful business minds of our day take many actions and give themselves many opportunities to earn the quote-unquote luck, most people do the opposite. They go to their day job, which pays their bills. Then they spend the rest of their time watching TV, playing video games, and going out to dinner with their friends. They are not giving themselves an opportunity to find lucky situations. If these people would dedicate some time every day to looking for investment opportunities, they would be surprised at how lucky they get. With rare exception, luck will not present itself to you unless you are out there searching for it. The Millionaire Fast Lane by M.J. DeMarco. The Millionaire Fast Lane explains why the world may be full of creative and hardworking people, but only a small portion of them become rich. This book explains how the conventional wisdom on how to attain riches are no longer applicable today. Thankfully, there is a way to success. And if you're willing to follow it, the Millionaire Fast Lane will get you there quicker than you think. So what does the traditional wisdom say you should do to become rich? Go to college. That's the big one, right? How could you possibly ever do anything more than flip burgers at a fast food joint if you don't have a college education, right? Then, of course, there are the empty axioms like work hard and save money. I suppose these make sense, but don't help much regarding specifics. What am I supposed to be working hard at? Last time I checked, flipping burgers at a fast food joint was pretty hard work. I'd much rather put in a 12-hour day of mindful intellectual work as opposed to 8 hours of mind-numbing, unappreciated burger flipping while being barked at by managers. Saving money makes sense, but how do you expect to save your way to being rich when you aren't making much money to begin with? What if you don't want to put your dimes away for the next 50 years so you can pull it out right before you die to have dollars? What if you want to enjoy your life right now? If this makes sense to you, then the Millionaire Fast Lane was made for you. This book discusses a new strategy for becoming rich, and it all starts with your mind. The first thing you need to do is forget all the old-school thinking your middle-class parents taught you. If your parents aren't rich, you shouldn't expect them to be qualified to give you proper advice on how to get rich. So let go of the old and be prepared to let in the new. How did rich people become rich? Did they just get lucky? Was it fate? Most people will say yes. Most people are also poor. If you believe the path to riches is laden with luck or destiny, you might as well give up now, because it's out of your control. However, I don't think you'd be reading a book on how to become rich if you didn't believe at some level that you were the one driving the ship. Most people are passengers. You are not most people. You are the driver of your own life and financial situation. If you are poor, accept it is because you decided to be poor. Yes, it is not fun to admit, but get over it. Stop making excuses. And let's move on and get you rich. Once you have accepted that you are in control of your own destiny, where do you go? To figure that out, you need to set a plan. The lack of a plan will cause you to be unprepared for tough situations and ultimately increase the risk of failure. There are many things which can cause dramatic trauma without a proper plan set in place. Most people would be financially devastated if they lost their job. If they become ill, they would run out of money in a matter of weeks to a few months. If an economic recession hit, their business would be destroyed. So too would their money, and sometimes even their overall quality of life. You must take responsibility for your financial well-being and your life in general. Spend your money like you are going to die tomorrow will inevitably result in mitigated savings, excessive debt, and poor credit. It is not the uncommon story to hear of a rapper or athlete who was earning millions of dollars per year, only to retire in massive debt and be forced to file for bankruptcy. These are individuals who have no self-control and are not planning for tomorrow. The ironic truth is, if you live like there is no tomorrow, there won't be as many of them, and they certainly won't be as enjoyable. These types of people defend their actions by saying they, in fact, could die tomorrow. They could get into a car crash or find out they have cancer. While this is a possibility, it is unlikely to occur anytime soon. On the other hand, your bills are inevitable. Those are coming no matter what. Plus, even if you do end up in a situation where you are in a horrible car crash, what if you don't die? What if you incur hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical bills and are stuck in a wheelchair for the rest of your life? What if you have certain disabilities which require you to have an around-the-clock nurse for the rest of your life? What if your battle with cancer lasts years and you are unable to work for that period? These are not pleasant thoughts, but wouldn't you like to have a significant chunk of money in the bank? So, we need to get rich, but how? Unless we are working in a job which pays quite well, we cannot follow the conventional wisdom of saving and conservative investing. You cannot simply work more hours. There is a physical limit as to how many hours you can work, and there are many jobs where no matter how well you perform, you are not going to be paid significantly more or receive a promotion. There are higher reward bets you can choose on the stock market, but these are risky, and you may lose everything you have worked so hard for. Plus, if you keep your savings in a bank, you are allowing inflation to effectively eat away at your money. Working hard your entire life and saving for when you are old and brittle is not a motivating idea. People do not want to think about when they are so old they will not enjoy their quality of life, regardless of how much money they have. Instead, why not retire young? Why not retire when you are still full of energy and physical strength? You do not necessarily have to permanently retire. But why not take an indefinite vacation where you can enjoy the benefits of retirement in your 30s, 40s, or 50s? Of course, you will have to make more money to do this. That is the whole point. Is education the path to a higher income? Statistically, you will make more, but not enough to make you rich. Plus, the average college education will cost you around $60,000. For most students, that means taking out a loan with interest. There are plenty of college graduates who took on this $60,000 of debt, with promise of a great job upon completion. Come to find out, they were unable to attain any relevant job in their field. 4 years and $60,000 down the tube, and they are working alongside people who never attended college. College does not guarantee financial wealth. Fortunately, you don't need a college education. What you need is the ability to think outside of the box. New innovative business ideas and implementations do not require you to have spent 4 years in college. What becoming rich likely will require is a specific skill which you are extremely proficient at. You may need to learn to code, or to succeed at online marketing, or become a well-connected networker. General knowledge will not make you rich. Specialized expertise will. Being rich is important. But is being rich the only factor in determining wealth? Wealth is more than financial well-being. Wealth is having a healthy relationship with friends and family. Wealth is being physically healthy and fit. Wealth is freedom. While money certainly can help strengthen relationships and improve your health, where it really comes into play is freedom. The more money you have, the higher degrees of freedom you have. The rich man does not have to take orders from an incompetent boss. The rich man does not have to work at all if he so desires. The rich man can go where he wants, when he wants, and do what he wants. Unless you are lucky enough to be in a job you both enjoy and make good money at, a multiple six-figure income, you are left primarily with starting your own business. This does not have to be a business in the traditional sense. You could invent a product, patent it, and license out the rights. All you need to do at that point is sit back and collect royalties for the next 20 years. Of course, you should probably continue to invent new products to produce multiple streams of income. You could also start a YouTube channel, Instagram page, or write a book. These may not seem like businesses, but make no mistake, the top YouTubers are earning over $1 million a year. The top Instagram models are earning several hundred thousand a year. And the top authors like J.K. Rowling and James Patterson have earned hundreds of millions of dollars throughout their career. So you do not need to create a traditional brick-and-mortar store selling standard retail items. Today, there are many more options to grow income and become rich. You just need to pick one and have the confidence to go out and do it. Start doing your homework. Take a course on advertising. Stop looking at the world as a consumer and start being a producer. Consider how an idea is transformed into a product. How do they get financing? How much does it cost? How do they get it manufactured? How do they sell and advertise it? If you truly want to become rich quickly, the best way is to start a business, develop and sell a product, outsource the manufacturing and day-to-day operations, then sit back and collect your royalty check. Aim to build a business like Richard Branson did. He gets the business up and running and profitable. He then hires a management team to take over as soon as possible. This hands-off approach has allowed him to accumulate over 400 businesses in his Virgin Group. One simple indicator of determining whether you are on the right path or not are paychecks. Do you have a single boss who writes your checks and can fire you? If so, this is likely the wrong path. On the other hand, do you write checks every 2 weeks to people who are working for you? If so, this is likely the correct path. Of course, this is not always the case. But generally, if you depend upon a boss for your paycheck, you are not going to become rich. If you are the one cutting the check, then you are the boss. The boss gets rich. The employees get a paycheck. Which are you getting? How many times have you heard this advice? Do what you love and you will never have to work a day in your life. This may be true, but you also may never make a single penny in your life either. The marketplace does not care what you love. You need to do what the marketplace wants. That is not to say you must do something you hate, but do something you both love and has a place in the market. For example, your favorite three hobbies may be playing adult league flag football with your coworkers, trying new restaurants and foods, and playing video games. More likely than not, performing these direct activities, even at an expert level, will not make you rich. But what could you do? You could organize a league for professional flag football. But this market is likely not large enough to make you rich. You could create some sort of in-person or online group about trying new foods. This has potential to develop into something large like Yelp. However, you would likely require significant seed capital to attain the requisite number of users to make the app or website self-sustaining. This makes the option possible, but not ideal. A third option would be to develop a video game for the Android or Apple App Store. This is something which would, of course, require time, particularly if you do not know how to code, but a significant time investment is required for starting almost any business. The good news is, this third option would require very little capital, perhaps a few hundred dollars if that. While you may not become rich overnight, you can immediately start collecting residuals on game sales. This will encourage and inspire you to either upgrade the game or develop a second game. Over time, you can begin to hire other game developers and continue to expand your brand. You can transform your love of playing games into the love of creating them for others to enjoy, and become rich in the process. There are many other options available to these three hobbies, but this illustrates the type of thinking required to become successful. You should not do whatever you want and hope you make money. Similarly, you should not do something you hate. Instead, make a list of things you enjoy, and then determine how much of a business you can structure around that passion. Pick the combination that you both love and can result in making you rich. The Millionaire Next Door by Thomas Stanley. The Millionaire Next Door reveals the truth about millionaires. Do they live lives of great luxury, drive supercars, flying jets, and living in mansions? This is likely the most pragmatic information you will ever receive on how to become a millionaire. This book will clearly illustrate how, if you are dedicated to frugality, saving, and investing properly, you too can become a millionaire. Millionaires, they live a life of glamour, set atop the Hollywood Hills, and being chauffeured down to the peasants in their Rolls Royce, right? Not quite. The life of the average millionaire is not what we imagine it to be. Most millionaires live in what most people would consider to be normal average houses, and drive normal average cars. What is interesting is they are not millionaires who happen to be frugal. Instead, they are millionaires because they are frugal. If you were a millionaire, would you dress in Prada, drink expensive wine, and buy designer watches and jewelry? While you see rappers, professional athletes, and trust fund babies being irresponsible with their money, the large majority of millionaires do not indulge in such irresponsible expenditures. If you desire to attain the status of a millionaire, you must become responsible with money for the moment you begin to earn it. Your desire to have money must far surpass your desires to look like you have money. Ironically, most people who look like they have money do not have much of it. All you need to do to demonstrate this is go to a low socioeconomic area. Here you will find a strong percentage of people who purchase expensive shoes, shirts, handbags, and jewelry. Yet they have very little money, and may in fact have purchased some of those items on credit. Most millionaires are the opposite of this. They save a reasonable portion of their income and do not spend on unnecessary items. The self-imposed control over budget is what allows normal everyday people to eventually become millionaires. The common millionaire does not overcomplicate money. They set out to have a certain net worth by a certain age, then figure out how much they must save every paycheck to accomplish that goal. Let us look at an average example of how real-life millionaires may make decisions. Mr. and Ms. Rule have a net worth of over $1 million. Like roughly 85% of millionaires in America today, they are first-generation self-made millionaires. They have a goal to have a combined net worth of over $5 million by the time they retire. To accomplish this, the couple will reinvest a portion of the income they receive from their business to expand it. They will also save a portion of the income for real estate investment. They each have one car, which costs around $30,000. Although they could purchase more expensive cars, they care more about investing in their business, real estate, stock market, and bond market. They have a strong desire to be financially independent. What is financial independence? Financial independence is when you have enough money to maintain your current standard of living for the rest of your life with no further work-related income. Those who are financially secure and desire to attain financial independence are clear about money-related goals and the time frames they need to be accomplished in. They organize strict budgets, set priorities, and stick to them. Mr. and Ms. Rule are financially secure. If they are physically injured or are forced out of work, they will still be able to continue their current lifestyle. They are doing so well, they can pay for their grandchildren's college educations if they desire to. Their net worth exceeds the expected wealth equation. The expected wealth equation is a simple formula which will give you an indicator as to what your current net worth should be if you were moderately fiscally responsible. If you desire to become a millionaire, it is best your net worth exceeds your expected net worth. Here is the equation. Multiply your age by your pre-tax annual income, then divide by 10. For instance, Mr. Big earned $200,000 last year. Mr. Big is 50 years old. When you multiply these numbers together, you get $10 million. Divide by 10, and you are left with an expected net worth of $1 million. Unfortunately, Mr. Big has an expensive car, expensive apartment, and expensive lifestyle. He is only worth about $270,000. Mr. Big is what we call an under-accumulator of wealth, meaning he does not accumulate wealth at the same rate a more fiscally conservative individual would. If millionaires do not spend money on extravagant items, how do they spend their money? Most millionaires are small business owners. Most millionaires reinvest a large portion of their income back into their business. While millionaires tend to be more frugal than most, they are not frugal when it comes to investing in their business. They are also willing to pay more than average for tax advice, investment advice, and medical care. While a fake millionaire is more likely to spend money on a car or clothing, a real millionaire is more likely to spend on additional office space, employees, manufacturing, or premium software services. The common millionaire spends more time than most reading and educating themselves on financial investments. They tend to make better investments, which result in an increased net worth over time. If a millionaire has specialized knowledge, they tend to focus their investments on their area of expertise. For example, Mr. Jones is an auctioneer for a living, Mr. Jones specializes in the auctioning off of commercial real estate. Naturally, Mr. Jones invests primarily in commercial real estate. Miss Long is a stay-at-home wife who has a passion for antique furniture. Over the years, she has developed enough knowledge to successfully purchase and sell antique furniture at a profit. Once these millionaires have achieved financial freedom, do they pass it on to their children? The results are split roughly down the middle, with 46% financially supporting their children and/or grandchildren in adulthood. On the other side, 54% do not provide any financial support of their children or grandchildren once adulthood is reached. They do, however, tend to pay for college and medical expenses. Interestingly, the children who do receive monthly cash infusions and have their rent paid for have nearly zero ability to save or manage money. These adult children will live off their parents their entire life, but if they are ever cut off, they often find themselves in extremely deep financial trouble. Conversely, the children who do not receive monthly cash gifts or have basic living expenses paid for tend to be both more responsible in saving and investing money. There are multiple reasons this is the case. Of course, individuals who are given money do not have a respect for it. This is evident by the fact most lottery winners go broke in an average of 4 years. There is more to the answer than just this, however. Children learn spending habits from their parents. The parents who support their adult children tend to spend money more frivolously when compared to the millionaires who do not support their children. Each set of children adopts the spending habits of their parents, so saving and investing your money is not only helping you become more financially independent, it is also helping your children become financially independent. When it comes to passing down wealth after death, most millionaires state they will divide their wealth equally between children. However, this is not the case. Affluent parents are far more likely to pass down larger portions of money to daughters who became housewives. Most affluent parents, particularly the men who often are the primary financial provider, believe their sons can earn their own money. In contrast, if they have a daughter who is a stay-at-home mother, the belief is she is unable to earn her own money, and therefore it is more acceptable to give her a larger inheritance. This same situation applies to economic outpatient care, which is when the parents are contributing to the child's financial well-being on a monthly or annual basis. Stay-at-home mothers are by far the most likely to receive economic outpatient care from affluent parents. While these differences are most notable when looked at as a demographic across many families, the same discrepancies can occur even within the same family. It is common for an unemployed sibling to receive 50% more inheritance than his employed sibling. The discrepancy among siblings can be even greater with stay-at-home mothers compared to their working brothers. Some children receive monthly cash gifts and a hefty inheritance. Some do not. The world is not fair. However, those who are given more tend to ultimately end up with less due to poor money management. So perhaps it is those who are forced to become strong from the beginning who are truly the lucky ones. This has been the Business of Money, Personal Finance, and Investing for the 21st Century. Written by Knight Rider. Narrated by Richard Banks. Copyright 2017 by Knight Rider. Production copyright 2017 by Knight Rider.
Meditation and Mindfulness. Meditations, Buddhism, and Spirituality for Beginners. Written and narrated by Knight Rider. Are you looking to increase your mindfulness or knowledge of meditative practices, but are unsure where to begin? That is where meditation and mindfulness comes into play. We look at and summarize 15 of the greatest books ever written on the subjects. You will learn everything you need to know in order to get started in meditation and mindfulness. We will also cover spirituality, Buddhist traditions, and how they can be used to improve the day-to-day quality of your modern 21st century life. With more information and technology than ever before, our brains are constantly stressed and overloaded. However, with a few simple techniques, we can rid ourselves of that stress and live a happy, fulfilled, purpose-driven life. Unlike other books, which push one specific meditative or mindfulness practice and ignore all others, meditation and mindfulness takes the opposite approach and details all the common practices, allowing you to choose which works best with your personality and unique situation. Buddhism, Plain and Simple, by Steve Hagen. Buddhism, Plain and Simple, is your no-nonsense guide to essential Buddhist practices. From building awareness to living in the present moment, Buddhism's most important teachings are explained in a clear and accessible way and are linked to aspects of everyday life where we need them most. Say you spend a nice afternoon at the mall, meet some friends, enjoy some delicious ice cream, and even treat yourself to a new book, smartphone, or piece of clothing you had your eye on. But once back at home, you feel just worn out and empty, with all the excitement long gone. Or maybe you find yourself worrying constantly. Even the prospect of missing a train or being late for a payment is enough to cause you a headache. Then there are deeper worries about your children's safety or your job security. Many people in Western countries feel disconnected, depressed, and full of fear. What are we missing? And why are so many celebrities going to Buddhism? After all, Bill Clinton, Philip Glass, Orlando Bloom, and Tina Turner have all professed a liking for Buddhist thought. As you'll discover in this book, Buddhism has a lot to offer. It teaches that everything we are searching for is right in front of our noses. What we are craving is to experience reality, but our innumerable desires, fears, and opinions are separating us from the world as it really is. Fortunately, you are not doomed to live a false life. There are practices that will help you live in the moment, deal with painful emotions, and find your peace of mind. Do you feel empty and dissatisfied with your life? Do you feel you are missing out on something you can't quite put your finger on? In this case, Buddhism might provide some answers. Quite often, we suffer because we compare reality to our wishes or expectations of what reality should be. What we really should be doing is just being aware of the present moment. But since every aspect of our everyday life is dominated by habits that take us out of the present moment, this can be a very difficult task. We spend much of our time judging ourselves, others, and situations based on what we expect them to be. For instance, if it rains in the summer, we are unhappy because we expected the weather to be sunny. If we are not finding new ways to feel disappointed, we are fixated on petty wishes, coveting a new car, a dream home, or a perfect complexion. All these wishes and expectations are keeping us from reality. They keep us from experiencing that cool rain as anything else than the frustrating absence of the weather we wanted or expected. This take on the world makes us unhappy for two reasons. First, we are hungry for real experiences, and we are missing out on them unless we appreciate what is really there. Second, we are experiencing reality to be something it is not, and thus setting ourselves up for disappointment. Buddhism teaches us that we'll suffer as long as we continue to fight change. We see change as another step toward death, and we do not want to die or lose our loved ones. As a result, we are trapped in a circle of confusion, alarm, and dissatisfaction. If so much of our pain is linked to our inability to perceive reality just the way it is, how can we become aware of things as they are? Buddhism does not advise us to give up control, but rather to acknowledge that we never had it in the first place. Change is inevitable. We all change from the moment we are born. We grow, we mature, we age, and we die. These processes are out of control. Just like us, everything and everyone around us also changes. Buddhist practices can function like a raft you can use to get from one shore of the lake to the other, traveling away from the side of human suffering like dukkha. The eight key practices are the right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Firstly, to find peace of mind, you need to forego the tendency to see the world as a backdrop of fixed concepts. The world is a whole, and it is changing all the time. Just think of the circle of life or water going from fluid to gaseous or solid forms. Despite this, we tend to look at a single, temporary aspect and try to freeze it into a concept or opinion. It is like looking into a kaleidoscope and fixating on just one little aspect, and then saying that is the whole thing. But just think of how many different possible ways there are to perceive something. For instance, say a boy tames a rat. In his eyes, this rat is cute, cuddly, and lovable, while his mother perceives it as filthy and disgusting. Both takes on the rat are subjective, arbitrary, and incomplete. These different views can be a source of much conflict if, say, that mother kicks the rat out of her house. By learning not to judge others' views or interpreting them arbitrarily, we can eliminate conflict. The Buddha calls this adopting the right view. The right intention is the firm resolve to see things as they really are. It is the intention to come back to the present moment, to be aware of this moment, and to simply be awake without wanting other things in your life. You could even say that the right intention is the firm resolve to practice the right view again and again. If the right intention is the firm resolve to see things as they really are, does this mean that we should push ourselves toward enlightenment? Well, not quite. What Buddha called the right effort is making sure that you act and think without straining and never try to control what you cannot. For instance, unless you're moving through a swamp, natural movement should not require you to push yourself. If it does, you're not doing it right. Right effort implies that you should never strain to achieve enlightenment, and that you should not worry about doing so. The right effort is about not trying to control what is out of your hands. Like the old saying goes, you can take a horse to the water, but you cannot make it drink. Meanwhile, the right mindfulness can help you to find your calm. In everyday life, we tend to just react to a certain situation or to suppress that reaction. As long as we live this way, we remain very vulnerable to external influences, and even the smallest things can irritate us. Just think of the maddening noise of a dripping tap. By practicing the right mindfulness, you'll do something different. You won't focus on the situation, but instead on how it makes you feel. Focus on your reaction without judgment. Where in your body do you feel that annoyance? Do you grit your teeth? Does your head pound? After doing this for a while, do you feel your breathing deepening, your jaw relaxing? Practicing mindfulness has a calming effect. When practicing the right mindfulness, you'll realize what is really ailing you is your own reactions, and that you often bring them on with your own thoughts and attitudes. In our daily lives, we still experience similar philosophical dilemmas as people did in the time of Buddha. We regularly ask ourselves, "What am I? What happens to me when I die? Do I depart after death?" We tend to take for granted that each of us has a distinct personality, a self. But for centuries, there's been a lot of debate and confusion about the nature of that personality. One camp argues for the existence of an immortal soul that is just temporarily trapped inside a physical body. In Hinduism, this immortal soul is called Atman. The opposing theory, materialism, holds that we are nothing but a psychophysical being. Thus, as soon as our body dies, our mind expires too. As well as describing popular atheistic beliefs, this theory also goes back to ancient India. According to Buddhism, both these positions fall prey to the same illusion. In reality, there is no such thing as a self or personality. With notions like personality, soul, or self, we try to capture fluent, ever-changing phenomena with frozen, immutable concepts. You could say that we tend to see ourselves as corks floating in a stream of time. Buddhism criticizes these concepts as frozen views. If you look inside, you will find that you are changing all the time. Your ideas, emotions, thoughts, and attitudes are in constant flow. When Buddha spoke about individuals, he used the word stream because of this constant movement that is central to our lives. In this way, we are not floating in a stream. We ourselves are the stream. Reality can often appear to exist as a world of contrasts and differences. But why is that actually the case? It is because our worldviews are made up of relative truths, which we use to make sense of the world. Relative truths are arbitrary, produced in our own minds as we isolate one object or concept and set it apart from what it is not, like a picture and a background, a man and a woman, or good and evil. Like an optical illusion that depicts either a vase or two faces in profile, it depends on how you see it. In fact, our entire language is also based on relative truths. Since we are in permanent contact with relative truths, we forget that they are arbitrary. But in truth, everything belongs to a whole, and everything is connected. Everything happens as a result of another event, and nothing in this world appears by itself. Furthermore, every conception we create about something simultaneously creates an opposite one. If you think of darkness, you define it as the absence of light. Both are inseparable parts of a whole. This wholeness is the absolute truth. While every word attempts to cut the world into parts, the absolute truth is direct, immediate perception, which means that nothing can be separate. Final summary. As we learn to stop making judgments of ourselves, others, and the situations we face, we can break out of the cycle of confusion and dissatisfaction. In beginning to practice with new approaches to living with mindfulness and deeper intentions, we'll find ourselves able to remain within the present moment and enjoy it. This concludes Buddhism, Plain and Simple by Steve Hagen. "10% Happier" by Dan Harris. 10% Happier demystifies the ancient art of meditation by explaining recent cutting-edge scientific research into how meditation affects your body and mind. Importantly, it shows you just how valuable meditation can be in coping with the chaos and stress of the modern world. How many times have you become overwhelmed by emotions, so completely ruled by them, that in anger or desperation you make a terrible decision that you later end up regretting? Or how many times has something as simple as waking up on the wrong side of the bed completely ruined what could have been an otherwise pleasant day? This book will show you how you can manage your emotions through meditation. The author will share his own compelling personal anecdotes so you can better understand that the ancient art of meditation is far more than a New Age fad. It can truly change your life. In fact, recent scientific studies have shown that mindfulness and meditation can have profound effects on your mental and physical health and your well-being. Meditation can even help make you more productive, regardless of how you live your life, by helping you conquer your ego and manage your emotions. We hear the word ego quite often. Your spouse might call you egotistical. Your best friend is egocentric. And armchair philosophers invoke Freudian buzzwords, blaming personal shortcomings on the ego. But the ego is far more nuanced than we give it credit. In our everyday interactions, we often refer to the ego as the source of pride, conceit, or self-love. To most, the ego is the source of behavior that is self-serving or unconcerned with the well-being of others. To Freud, the ego represents a psychological mechanism that mediates between our morality and our base desires. But these definitions of ego still do not get to the heart of the matter. We can talk about deep desire or fiery pride, but we still cannot explain what is going on in our heads when we do strange things like open the fridge without actually being hungry. A better way to think of your ego, and certainly one that offers you the most insight into your behavior, is as the voice in your head. Your ego comments on your actions and behavior from the moment you open your eyes in the morning until you drift off to sleep at night, telling you what to do and what not to do. This is not the kind of voice in your head that is attributed to psychosis. Rather, you can think of it as a voice that manifests through thoughts. For example, your ego is the voice that tells you, "I am way too tired to go to the gym," even when you know you really could stand to break a sweat. It is what makes you obsessively check your emails 1,000 times per day, or gaze into the refrigerator, even when you are not hungry. As you will see, the ego is responsible for a great deal of what you do. Luckily, taking steps to rein your ego in can make us happier and healthier. The ego is never satisfied. It will always want. It will never be content, and it will never be perfectly happy. By design, the ego will always want more than it already has. When the ego is fed a new thing, this simply resets the baseline for desire, and immediately the ego begins reaching for something more. It does not matter matter how many material possessions you have, nor does it matter how much money you have spent acquiring them. Even if you don't need it, you still yearn for the newest sports cars or that new hot gadget. The best meals are not satisfying, even when they are prepared by the best chefs. Soon, you'll become hungry and yearn for a meal that is even tastier than the last. In essence, no matter how many times you try to satisfy your ego's desires, your ego will only want more. The ego is obsessed with the past and the future, and in its obsession, neglects the present, thus keeping you from fully living in the now. The ego loves especially to dwell in the past and thrives on drama by keeping old wounds open. It is the reason that you complain to your spouse about a work problem while having dinner, and it is what causes you to lament being jilted by your first love at 17, despite being happily married today. Your ego constantly assesses your worth against your appearance, wealth, and social status of others, but will always find something wrong with you, no matter how smart, beautiful, or wealthy you may be. According to your ego, there is always someone smarter, more beautiful, and has more money. Thus, your ego will spur you to continually strive to become that better person. But after achieving what your ego wants, will you be happy? No, of course not. The ego is never happy. Just think of all the rich, famous, or fortunate people who have committed suicide, become addicted to drugs, or otherwise ruined their lives. When we practice meditation, we learn a valuable skill called mindfulness. Mindfulness is the ability to respond and not react to our surroundings as well as our impulses. Meditation increases our mindfulness by instructing us to immerse ourselves fully in the present moment and not to be overwhelmed with life's stresses. For instance, when a colleague told the author that he would never become a big-time anchorman, he used his newfound mindfulness to respond rather than react. He did not let his ego and anger control him, but instead calmly asked his boss how he could improve his work. Mindfulness does not just improve your decision-making, it also changes your biology. A Harvard MRI study observed that people who had taken an 8-week mindfulness course through meditation had developed thicker gray matter in the areas of the brain associated with self-awareness and compassion. Likewise, mindfulness training appeared to shrink the regions in the brain associated with stress. This increase in compassionate behavior, that is, practicing concern for your own well-being and for the well-being of others, is not something to be overlooked. Demonstrating compassion toward yourself improves your decision-making by allowing you to forgive yourself for mistakes and accept your flaws. In fact, studies have demonstrated that people trained in self-compassion meditation are more likely to demonstrate healthier behavior, such as quitting smoking or eating healthier. Likewise, being compassionate toward others actually helps you to become a more fulfilled individual. One study asked participants for a few days to wear tape recorders which would record their conversations. The recordings verified that participants who practiced meditation were more empathetic, spent more time with others, and laughed more and used the word I less. Indeed, we can use compassion for others to our own advantage. As the Dalai Lama put it, be wise selfish, rather than foolish, selfish. Some people dread the Buddhist concept of letting go, as they see it as going soft or becoming ineffective, an act of capitulation. For example, the American author and psychotherapist Mark Epstein often recounts the story of his Buddhist patients who denied themselves orgasms during sex or refused to place orders at restaurants themselves as a means of not expressing personal preference. Obviously, this sort of behavior did not make them happier people. Controlling your ego does not mean